introduce our guest speaker today. And first, I want to say welcome to everyone from Jennersville joining us via live stream. It's great to have you with us today. And I'm delighted to announce and introduce our guest speaker today. Saju Matthew is a vice president with International Justice Mission. That is the work that we've been partnering with for about 10 years now. And they fight human trafficking around the globe. You've heard us say many times, there are more slaves in the world today than during the 400 years of transatlantic slave trade in our history and in other nations' histories. There are more slaves in the world today. In fact, there are as many slaves in India, where our partnership rests, than during that whole time of the transatlantic slave trade. And so it is a very real and horrible, horrible problem. But IJM is fighting it. They're fighting it at the level of national government policy. They're fighting it at the street level, doing investigations and raids, bringing justice to people who are oppressed. And it's just wonderful that we get to have Saju with us today. You know, he's kind of grown with us over the years. Some of you who were here a decade ago, Saju came to our church and brought a message to us 10 years ago when he was brand new with IJM. And I just learned this morning, that was his first ever like church presentation of IJM. So they kind of tested him out on little old Willowdale Chapel. Now, 10 years on, he's vice president. He oversees all the operations in South Asia, and we get to have him back because I guess we've grown too, maybe just a little tiny bit in our stature with IJM as a whole. And Saju, by the way, he's a native of India, but he grew up in Philadelphia. He did his undergrad work at Penn. He has a law degree from Rutgers. He previously worked for the Attorney General of the state of New Jersey. Then left there to join IJM's team and now heads up a large swath of it. He's going to come in just a few moments to bring our message today. But first, we want everyone to take a look at the screen and watch this short video.
আমার নাম সাধনা যখন ছোট ছিলাম তখন আমার ভয় বলে কিছু ছিল না আমি যখন ছোট ছিলাম তখন গাছে উঠতাম মাছ ধরতাম তো তখন এইসব জিনিসে আমার কোনো ভয় থাকতো না মানে তখন কোনো ভয় লাগতো না যে কে বকবে কে মারবে আমার সঙ্গে যেটা হয়েছিল সেটা থেকে আমি খুব ভয় পেয়ে গেছিলাম আমার জীবনে কিছু হবে না আর আমার জীবনে কোনো দাম নেই আমি একটা মূল্যহীন মেয়ে হয়ে গেছি তখন এরকমই হতো Thank you. এখন আগের থেকে আমি অনেক বেশি সাহসী হয়ে গেছি।
Good morning to everyone. It's just a real privilege to be back with you all. You know, I thought since this is the first church that IGM ever sent me to, let me do this. As I was preparing, I thought, let me share about the very first person that I've ever met who was actually a slave. So that's what I wanted to focus on today and just share, and then also share from the Word of God as well. But a little bit about the video you saw. I actually got to see Sadhana last month when I was in India. She's about 18 years old now, and she's doing phenomenally well. She is, as the last part of the video showed, she goes around and speaking. So she has the courage to tell her story. And so the government of India gave her a champion award as a survivor. And she was presented with that, and she's almost finished high school. So she's a feisty, strong young woman, and about 2 years ago, she became a Christian and became baptized. She attends a small church with about 30 other survivor girls. It's called Freedom Church. And I also had an opportunity to go to that church and just worship. So it's just beautiful to see how God keeps writing the stories, right? And so it's exciting for me to be back because I had never imagined the journey of my life. But I am from Philadelphia, and I remember my early days. I moved to the U.S. from India in the late 70s, and it was practice for us to come and come to Longwood Garden. I remember so many times coming to this area and being a part of Longwood Garden. My parents are here with me. They live in Springfield in Delaware County now. So it's phenomenal to sort of how, as you look at the long arc of time, how God sort of brings things back around. And so it's just my privilege and my pleasure to be here. So thank you so much for just the way you have been supporting and praying and encouraging the work that IGM is doing around the world. This morning I thought I'll have us jump into this issue of fear. I want to just look at what does fear do to a person, right? It's physically, but also the mind of a person. What does that do? Or when you're victimized by violence, if you can imagine, for example, for Sadhana, right? I mean, what does that do to an individual's psyche, you know, their sense of self? And I want to talk about fear in the sense of fear without any hope, right? We may have all been in situations that are fearful or scary. I can think of an example that sometimes it doesn't seem scary, but then it is, and you panic. If you've ever been on a flight, right, on a plane, and every once in a while, I've been on a flight that sometimes it just seems bumpier than usual. And I remember one particular flight when I was in India. I think I was traveling from one city to another, and it just felt too shaky, right? And I'm sitting there, but all the passengers, nobody wants to look silly and react, right? So you're all just kind of sitting there, but not trying to act like you're not an expert flyer or a seasoned flyer. But then the plane took this like drop, like we all felt it, right? Your bodies moved. And then everybody grips, and I still remember everybody looked at each other, like, do we have the signal to be afraid, or should we just all kind of pretend that we're okay? But at that moment, right, when I'm afraid that something might happen to the plane, there's nothing else that I can think of, right? I don't care what movie is playing right now. I don't care if I've gotten my choice of dessert on the plane, or if the plane is on time, or it's going to be half hour late. I just want to land safely, right? When you're afraid, when your safety is undermined, and you don't know how to get out of it, that just grips your mind. And that's what I think happens when a person is afraid. But what about the kind of fear where there's no way out? You know, the kind of fear where it just seems pointless to even try to do something about it. So today I want to tell you two stories. As I mentioned, one story I'll tell you is one of my one from IJM, but the other story is from the Bible. So what I'll do today is I'd like to go back and forth. So if you have a Bible, you can follow in the book of Judges, chapter 6. But you may be familiar with the story. It's about a person named Gideon. So that's what I'd like to look at today. So We're going to look at Gideon's story and then, you know, one of our IGM clients, the very first person that I'd ever met. So it's interesting because this story is found in the book of Judges. And let me sort of paint the setting for you. It's in Judges chapter 6, and I'll read chapter 6, verses 3 to 6, just to sort of set the background, and you can see what's going on here. It says, "For whenever the Israelites planted crops, the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east would come up against them. They would encamp against them and devour the produce of the land as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance in Israel and no sheep or ox or donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tent. They would come like locusts in number. Both they and their camels could not be even counted. So they laid waste the land that they came in. And Israel was brought very low because of Midian. And the people of Israel cried out for help for the Lord." This is the background in which God comes and calls Gideon to be a judge. This is a situation. Israel is still a very young nation, living among much more powerful nations that have established their military might and their force, and they have been there for a long time. And as the harvest season came, some of the more powerful nations, it says the Midianites and the Amalekites and those kingdoms to the east would just come up and say, "Well, we can just take what we want. We can plunder whatever we want." And it said that they would come on a regular wave. This was their experience. Because if you can imagine Israel, year after year, this is how they lived. In fear and apprehension of how much are they really going to be able to have of what they planted. And how much is going to be just totally stolen away from them. But it seems like the forces against them, these other armies, were just so powerful that it didn't make sense to fight it. Right? They seem to have already given up. They're crying out to the Lord because they just laid waste. It's too big. So this is a situation where I see a scenario where the threat against you, the violence against you is too big for you to handle. And so you probably figure out a way just to lay down and protect your life and give up your stuff because at least you'll survive. That's probably the kind of approach that many of them just took and decided that's the way to do it, just so we can continue to live. And it was while this was happening in Israel that it says the angel of the Lord came, and that's in verse 11, it picks up and it tells us, angel of the Lord came to a man named Gideon, and he calls Gideon. That is the person that God chooses to be the answer to this situation. Now listen to the way he calls him. I'll kind of read parts of verses 11 and 12. It says, "And the angel of the Lord came, and while Gideon was beating out wheat in the wine press to hide it from the Midianites, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, 'The Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor.'" Or maybe if you have the NIV version, it says, "O mighty warrior." "The Lord is with you, O mighty warrior." So picture the scene right now, right? It says that the angel of the Lord comes, and where's Gideon? He's threshing the wheat. I'm not sure what threshing the wheat is. I didn't grow up in a rural environment, but I'm assuming that's some kind of, you know, farming step that you take. But he's beating the wheat and he's working on it. But it says that he's doing it in the wine press to hide from the Midianites, right? So he's gathered whatever he thinks he can. He's walked over to the wine press and he's going to do his work there because he's hoping that doesn't get stolen from him. So you don't necessarily have this first picture of someone who's this brave, tough guy who's going to say, "I'm going to guard my land and whoever comes has to get through me first." No, he's not, and you'll see throughout the story, he's actually quite afraid, right? So imagine this incredulity that he would have, the sort of confusion that he would have when the angel would say, "The Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor, O mighty warrior," right? If I were Gideon, and you'll get to know Gideon a little more, or I'll remind you of some of the things that you probably already know. But Gideon must have done one of these things. Me? If is one thing that is far from Gideon, he does not look at himself as mighty man, a mighty warrior. He's not that person at all. He doesn't see himself in that way. And you see that he will make excuses because in verse 14 it says, "The Lord turned to him and said, 'Go in the might of yours and save Israel from the hand of Midianites. Do I not send you?' And he says to him, 'Please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Behold, My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least of my father's house. And the Lord said to him, but I will be with you. So here's the dilemma that's happening here. Gideon hears the angel of the Lord come and ask him to take the lead in the battle against this powerful nation. And he starts immediately processing as a rational human being and says, I'm not fit for this. In fact, my clan is the least of all the clans within my own tribe. In this tiny little tribe of Manasseh, you have the wrong guy. And you'll see that Gideon is constantly saying to himself and to the Lord in multiple ways throughout his story, you have the wrong guy. You have the wrong guy. He's afraid. He's afraid. He'd rather give up. He'd rather quit. He'd rather just put up with what's happening than to fight something that seems pointless to him. The second story I want to tell you is about a man named Kuti. And this is a picture, as you'll see, of the house where Kuti lives. This is it. This little one room was Kuti's home. He and his wife and his four kids. That's all of their life belongings. You see, Kuti has spent his entire life as a slave in a rice mill. That was his job. He is working for a powerful owner who owned vast amounts of businesses and land, and he had trapped Kuti in this situation and his family in this situation where he was a slave. Growing up, that was his life as a kid. He knew nothing else but to do that because he was a son of a slave. And what we find is that inside of these kind of places, when you have different slave families living, it just sort of becomes their life for many generations. So he and his wife, he married a girl who also grew up inside of a rice mill. And you'll find sometimes owners selling the slave from one, you know, one business to another, one enterprise to another. So, you know, Kuti had moved around a little bit, but at some point he had met the woman that he would marry, but she was also a slave, and they had four children, and they're living in this situation. And this was their entire life. He doesn't decide when he gets up. He doesn't decide when he eats. He doesn't decide when he sleeps. He's basically property. And so his children, at the time when I met him, and this was, you know, when I first joined IGM, his children were between the ages of 5 and 13. And none of them were getting an education. None of them were able to go to school. And what that means, if you just don't learn to read by the time you're 8, 9, 10 years old, is you have no marketable skills in this world. And so you're going to be able to be trapped and repeated in the same situation. And the problem was that, you know, Kuti had no way of fighting back. He had no way of fighting back. The owner was just too powerful. And so my first experience was when our investigators secretly went to document Kuti. And so I had the experience of going there, and this is the first time that I saw him, and this is what he looked like. And I remember, you know, what our investigators do is we tried to find a way to connect with people, and so we had found a way to, they had found a way to connect with him, and they had asked him to meet outside about a half a kilometer, you know, half a mile away, outside of the rice mill at a certain time when you feel like the owner may not be able to know where your whereabouts are. And then we'll document your information. We want to talk to you. And so the first time I saw him, I saw this man was just so tremendously scared, right? He just did not have the capacity to look up at us. He's actually a shorter individual, and he just would not look at us. He would put his head down. He didn't know what to expect. You know, it's one of these things where a person can be alive physically, but when you look at their eyes, their face, there's a deadness there. So what I've learned over the years is it's sort of a coping mechanism to survive in total abuse. You know, Sadhana tells the same story. The only way you can survive day after day after day of rape and abuse and violence is to just stop having any feelings, thinking, dreaming, wanting. Make yourself into just a thing so that you can just bear it. Because the saddest thing is to be in a situation where you can't protect your wife when she's getting beaten, or to do anything when you're getting beaten and have you be humiliated in front of your whole family. The saddest thing is that when his kids are sick, he can't do anything to help them. He can't take them to the hospital or give them medicine. He completely has to beg the owner for whatever the owner might give or help out, and that's how he lives. That was his situation. And his eyes said, I'm really scared, and he has never had any education. So our investigators, what they're trying to do is trying to prepare him to be able to gather his information, but also rescues and things like that work like any law enforcement situation here. If you're a victim of a crime, when police come in, you have to be able to say what your situation is, right? It has to come from your mouth that, hey, yes, this is what happened to me. But that's the hardest part for these people, you know, that to be able to say that. And so I remember one of the things that we showed him what is $100 note, and we asked him, what is this? He couldn't identify the denomination. So then they asked him, how old are you? And so you might have a guess as you take a look at that picture. He had no idea what numbers was. He felt a little embarrassed and overwhelmed by the question. He didn't say anything initially. And then he just threw out a number because that's some word that he had known. And he said, 12? And I just felt this sense of, oh my gosh, here's a human being who's been stripped of any opportunity for life. Of course he's going to stay trapped here. You don't have to put him in chains. You don't have to put a wall around the facility. You've beaten down his hope. You've put him in such state of fear and helplessness that this is where he's going to stay. You've had him submit to you. And so what we find is that Kutti is part of a community in India called the Dalits, or the Untouchables. They're the lowest part of the community. There's about 250 million people in India are part of that Dalit community. So because they are part of that community, it's easy to victimize them. Because they have low standing, they are just sort of looked down on in general. And so they just feel like they're sort of the forgotten, invisible part of that world. And so this is why the slavery happens to this community, and people just seem to look the other way. So the question that I have is, as we continue on, is how does God deal with a fearful person? Where's God in this? Where's God in these stories, and how does God deal with it? Well, let's go back to Gideon's story. You see, Gideon is not convinced that he's the right man. So what he says is he offers something, and this is something that commonly in the Middle East community then, when if travelers are coming in, you offer a meal. That's a thing to do. So that's what he does. It says here, this is what Gideon says to the angel of the Lord, and he said to him, if I have found favor in your eyes, then show me a sign that it is you who speak with me. Please do not depart from here until I come to you and bring out my present and set it before you. And the angel said, I will stay until you return. So Gideon went to the house and he prepared a young goat and unleavened cakes from an ephah of flour. I'm not sure what an ephah is. The meat he put in a basket and the broth he put on a pot, and he brought it to him under the terebinth tree and presented it to them. So Gideon, because he's afraid, he's asking for a sign. But as a hospitable person, you know, in those places, he's offering a meal. Now, making a meal is not convenient in those days as it is here. You don't go into a refrigerator, you look at the meat that you have, the ingredients, and I mean, it says here he had to start with an actual goat that was still alive, right? And so he's starting from scratch, from the beginning, preparing this meal. But what's interesting as I think about what's happening is, it's going to take some time. I don't know how long it takes to kill and prepare and turn it into a meal that you can put into a pot and bring it, and to make a cake as well. But at least an hour, maybe a few hours to prepare that. In Gideon's mind, I wonder what he's thinking. You know what? Eventually the angel's going to find out he had the wrong address. He has the wrong guy. Eventually he's probably just going to get up and go to the right place and say, you know what? Thank you for the meal. I appreciate it. But you know, I'm going to continue to journey on, right? And if I were Gideon, and I was scared, and I wasn't sure, are you sure, are you sure? I would probably walk out of my kitchen or the cooking area many times and look and see. And guess what? For that entire time, the angel of the Lord, just sitting there. Just being there and sitting there and not leaving, that itself is a sign that says, yeah, no, I didn't make a mistake. You're the one I came for. You're the one I want. You're the one. And so he prepares the meal and he lays it out, and he does get a sign. It says that fire comes out and consumes the food. That's a pretty amazing thing to see, right? I mean, that's not every day that you put a meal out there and fire comes from the ground and just consumes it all up. And you would think that is going to give Gideon this sense of, from the rock, right? And the food vanishes. That's going to give him a sense of, wow, okay. But it doesn't, right? Fear is deep. Changes your identity, and it's hard to let go. Because later on in the story, God tells Gideon, listen, I want you to offer a sacrifice to me in your hometown. Tear down the altars of Baal. And that's later in verse 25 onward. And Gideon is scared. He's not willing to do it. So he decides to do it in the middle of the night. And then all the townspeople are angry, saying, who did this? Who tore this down? And it's Gideon's dad who has to come to his defense because Gideon is hiding right now. And he says, look, since anybody want to get to my son, you have to go through me. Gideon is not exactly mustering up courage. And you see that in the most famously known scene in the story, right? Now the battle is about to start. They see that the army camp from the south is coming up. And here's the numbers. It's about 150,000 soldiers is what it's estimated that the Midianites. It says it's too much to count. It's as much as the locusts are. And so Gideon, as it's getting real now, it's one thing to say, okay, I'm going to probably do it, but now it's actually happening. There's signs of an actual battle, and Gideon is scared to death. And so Gideon asks for another sign, right? And you remember this, and I love this. It says, Gideon says in verse 36, then Gideon said to the Lord, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, behold, I'm laying a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there's dew on the fleece alone, and it is dry on the ground, then I'll know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you've said. And guess what? The next morning, when he gets up, right, it says he finds it exactly as it is, right? There's dew on the fleece, but the ground is dry. And Gideon has that very rational panic moment. Oh no, what if it was this patch of ground that's why it's wet? And maybe it's some sort of coincidence. So he has the guts or the gall, however you want to look at it, says, Lord, if it's not too much, he said, let not your anger burn against me. Let me speak to you just one more time. Please let me test just one more with the fleece. Please let it be dry on the fleece only, and on the ground let there be dew. And sure enough, what happened? The next morning, exactly as Gideon asked, right? The fleece was dry and the ground was wet. I don't think this is at all meant so that we would lay out fleeces and do these testing of God to find out what his will is. Not at all. I think God gives us these kinds of things to show us who he is. What kind of a God do we have? We have a God who draws close to someone who's scared, someone who's unsure, and meets him at the point of weakness. He sees his weakness. He sees the weakness of the vessel, the person that he's called. And he says, I will deal with your fear with tenderness, with closeness. I want you to see a visible reminder that I will stoop down to a fearful man and help him find courage to press on in a difficult situation. And for that reason it is, I think, God agrees. God is just showing his character and his attitude, his posture towards Gideon. He's trying to say what? Not that I have this power, but I'm with you. I'm for you. I'm with you. I'm for you. Coming back to the story of Kuti, as I said, one of the hardest things that our investigators have, and I watched as they were engaging in this, is to build up what we call victim support. These individuals have just learned never to speak in any situation. And so our biggest challenges, and this has happened, is we prepare the case, everything is good, we bring the police to there, and the victims just stay silent. I've gone into places as big as 150 sometimes of workers in a brick kiln or something like that. And 150 of them would be scared of just one owner and their people to not say anything, even though hope is waiting right there and they can exit out if they just says, yes, help me, I'm in trouble, I want to leave. That saying that takes so much. And so our investigators will continue to ask them, what is your story? Tell us this. What happened? Can you articulate it? You know, it's amazing. The truth is, many of them just don't know their story because they've never told it, talked about it. I would say just one advice for all of us. It's good for all of us to sort of know our story, to go back and play the story of how God is working in our lives. But what we're trying to do, our investigators are trying to do, is stoop down and build the courage of the victims in a way that they would speak up. And so, And Kuti's owner is actually a very rich man. He basically owns that entire town community. And he uses cheap labor in many places. And often what he says is, hey, the police are friends of mine. And so if you don't do what you're supposed to do, if you try to run away, You know, and Kuti and his family have been beaten up many times so that he knows what will come to him. Once you know the situation is against you, what are you going to do? But we actually prepared it, did all did the case, went in with the police and did the rescue operation. And I remember still to this day, it was my very first rescue operation that I'd ever been to. And we rounded the corner and we came in. And the whole thing is you want to move in and out very quickly. No more than 15 or 20 minutes because you want to catch the owner before he sort of figures out where is this coming from, right? Because he'll gather people and they'll actually even create a mob to fight and beat up the police as well. So it can be a very dangerous situation. And so I remember, you know, this is coming in and we're trying to have the government officials and we have, you know, government officials sort of arrest the owner. Our lawyers are trying to say, please separate him here. This is what it takes. As I said to you in that case, one of the cases where about 150 people wouldn't speak up. Just the eyes of the owner, just watching that person. Even if it's like this far away, that's all it takes for them to say nothing. So one of the things we really do is have our lawyers say, take the owner to another side, you know, put him over there, officer, so that these people have some sense that this is actually a hopeful thing to speak up. But I still remember, as Kuti was running around doing this, his eyes and my eyes met at this one point, and I won't forget it. He sort of looked up, and he like nodded as if to say, I can do this. I can do this. And he had gathered his family, and he had packed up the little bit that he had. And it seemed like there was this glimmer of hope in him. And what we do is when we take him out, and actually a mob started to gather, but we were able to take him out before it started to become dangerous, and the government will then take him to the police station, the government office, and do a full inquiry. They'll ask questions and all that kind of stuff. And so what you see here is on the day of rescue, this picture, this is a document that Kuti is getting. It's called a release certificate. And so the government issues what is called a release certificate saying you are released from any debt, obligation, or hold that this owner has on you. And if he comes back against you, the police will have to take action against the owner. And so this is actually the first legal document that he has that even establishes that he's a person, that he's a human being. He's an invisible individual in the country of India with no documentation of his own existence. This is the very first piece of paper that he has that just establishes that he's a human being and he's there, he exists. But what an amazing thing it is for us when they get that release certificate. That's the government saying, yes, the case is made. We agree that this was a case of slavery and we will take up the action on the prosecution side and we want to help him on the rehabilitation side. At that point, IJM's social workers, we have a team of social workers, we begin to work with Kuti and his family to begin a journey of restoration. And so our aftercare program lasts about 2 years. And we try to find a place for them to live, and we begin to help them to understand how it is that they can actually live in freedom. Coming back to the story, let me skip a little bit, because as I just painted, the situation is that this army situation with Gideon is not looking favorable, right? Because it actually starts out that Gideon starts out with about 32 people who respond from Israel, says, okay, you know, we'll fight. They don't have a standing army. They've never done this before, but they say, okay, we'll fight. And for whatever reason, you see God sort of whittles it down till the end. He's left with only 300. And as I said, we don't know the exact number, but historians say that the soldiers of the Midianites and the Amalekites would be somewhere in the range of 100 to 150,000 soldiers. I mean, that's ridiculous. How would you start a war when you have 300 against 100,000? I mean, what if it's even just 20,000? How would you possibly think that that's a fight worth starting up? That seems just like entering into a slaughter, right? So you have to ask, why would God put them in such a hopeless situation? How could there ever be a way to defeat an enemy so numerous, so powerful? Isn't it just better just to surrender and just stay alive? Which is the way Gideon had been thinking all along. I think that is a very important thing for us as Christians to realize, that this world is hard. It is aggressive. If you think back at, as Greg had mentioned, about the transatlantic slave trade, it was an institution so deeply embedded into the fabric, the mentality, the psychology, the economy of the world, that it made no sense to stop it. You couldn't pull it out. It was so interwoven. But it actually started, the movement, they say, started with just 12 men and women who one day gathered in above a print shop in London in an area called Clapham, and they were referred to as the Clapham sect. These were all Christians. They had no strategy, no idea, no sense of how to fight this battle, but they began to start a conversation and a movement. People like William Wilberforce and some of these others, Josiah Wedgwood, were a part of this movement. And that is what the beginnings was. But it ended, right? They were successful. They were able to tear it down. That's the approach that IJM is taking in the fight that we have. We look at this and we say, sure, 18 million slaves in India, over 40 million slaves worldwide, right? Millions of girls being trafficked into brothels, all kinds of places around the world where violence is so big. 4 billion people in the 7 billion population of the world, 4 billion live outside the protection of the law. And it just seems to be something that doesn't seem to be worth taking up as a fight. But we've seen over and over again that that's not true. I have seen remarkable things that IJM over the years has been able to rescue over 35,000 people from slavery. When we first started working in Chennai, where I was originally stationed, slavery was a massive problem. We just did a measurement of slavery, and this is what we found, just to give you a quick number. We looked at slavery in the entire state. The state is called Tamil Nadu. So we measured prevalence of slavery in the entire state, and we looked at these four districts, these four counties that IJM had been working on in for the last 10 plus years. And we found that slavery in the state, in the other districts, is 36%. 36% of the labor force in intense manual labor forces are all slaves. One out of every three people in intense manual labor force industries are slaves. In the four districts that we've been working in, it's 6%. It's remarkable to see, right? Change can happen. Fights can be successful. You can take it on. And I think God sort of puts this before us, puts it before Gideon, so that he can get the glory and we can realize, right, what a powerful God he is, what a beautiful God he is, as we sang today. He wants us to see the enormity of who he is, but Christians cannot experience that until we step in. Right? You remember that story as the Israelites had to cross the Jordan River. The river didn't part until what? They first put the foot in. Why? Is he just being a little bit of a teasing us and picking on us? Like, okay, well, let's see if you get... He wants us to see that as you take the step of courage, I will be there. It's possible. You can do that. That's the hope that we have. So how does the story end with Gideon? Well, in chapter 7 is the battle scene. And I think this is quite hilarious of what's happening, because Gideon is still scared. It's a night before the battle, and Gideon is still scared. And I'll read a little bit of it as we bring all of this to a close. It says, the Lord said to him, because Gideon is scared, and now the Lord is starting the conversation with him. The Lord said to him, arise and go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with your servant, his name is Purah, and you shall hear what they, the soldiers, the Midianite soldiers, are saying. And afterwards, your hand shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. So God tells Gideon, go down at night with your servant, because I want you to hear something that they're saying. And so guess what he hears? Gideon sneaks up in the middle of the night, behind the bushes or something like that, along with his servants, and this is what he overhears. And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east lay along the valley like locusts in abundance, and their camels were without number, as the sand that is on the seashore in abundance. When Gideon came, behold, a military man from the Midianite army, a man was telling a dream to his comrade. And he said, behold, I dreamed a dream, and behold, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian and came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent laid flat. That's the dream that he had. We all have sort of weird dreams that may not make sense. And his comrade answered him, this is no other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, the man of Israel. God has given into his hand Midian and all the camp. As soon as Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped. And he returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your land. Think about what God just pulled off there, right? Gideon is scared, right? Gideon is scared. So what lengths is God going to meet Gideon? He goes into the mind of an enemy soldier, gives the enemy soldier a dream that makes no sense on the face of it because a barley cake is going to roll down and knock down tents. But thankfully, the enemy soldier happens to have a soldier friend that's next to him who's capable of interpreting the dream. And his interpretation of the dream is what? Oh, that's a symbol that Gideon is going to destroy us, that God is giving us into the hands of Gideon. That is how ridiculous God is. That's the length that God goes to meet a man's heart that is timid and shaking. He puts a dream in one guy's head and has another guy interpret it, and has Gideon there crouching behind the bushes at the last minute to overhear all this, and Gideon is empowered there. Gideon is transformed there. He believes, oh my gosh, God is with me. It took a lot. Fleeces and food burning up and all that, but Gideon is there, and Gideon has victory over the soldier, over the Midianites, and he defeats them. Let me just share you a last bit about Kuti. So he successfully completed our aftercare program, and his family was doing well, and he began to be in his kids were in school, and they were thriving. And they were actually successful in the village. And so one day he called us in our office after he had already graduated. I think this is about 5 years late, 5 years after we had rescued him. And he said, hey, I'm thinking of something. He talked to this social worker that had cared for him. I want to run for elections in our local village to be the president of the five villages here. And we just said, well, I mean, our social worker said, well, of course, sure, with no sense, right? Whether he would do it or what that means, but why not? And so take a look at this photo. This is what we see, right? In Tamil Nadu, bonded labor turns redeemer, and he won the election. Right? The ridiculousness of our God. A man who lived his entire life as a slave, who thought that he was going to die as a slave, is now sitting with a white shirt and white pants as an official of the government, a president of his village, making decisions for his people, finding ways to help them, and leading his community to a brighter future. Our God reaches into things that just seems hopeless and impossible to us on the face. And we must realize that our God is far bigger than even our own imaginations can. I told you that there's a story of two people, right, of Gideon and Kuti, but I want to just add a third, and that's you and I. You see, we also have fears. We also have things. We may not be in slavery, but we have things that grip us in fear. We have things that we struggle with, we worry about, and we wonder the same things. God, are you going to show up? Are you there? There's the trials of our life. And so we wonder, well, okay, you showed up for Gideon. I get it. That was a biblical story you were trying to defeat, but what about in my life? Are you going to show up? I just want to encourage you, when life overwhelms you, when you have this sense of there's no one there, I'm all alone, please remember the words of the songs that we've been singing all this morning that reminds us of the cross, right? What is the cross a picture of? The cross tells me and tells you, God says to me, Saju, are you serious? Do you really think that I'm going to withhold showing up in this situation in your life? I gave up my son for you. I lost everything for you. I was nailed to the cross. I was stripped down. I was beaten. Jesus was separated from the Father. Heaven was silent. Why would you worry at all? That now, after I've given you my very best, my one and only begotten son, that I would somehow be stingy and hold back when you're in need. Don't let fear defeats you. Don't let the lies of the enemy tell you that I won't show up. Don't let things in this world seem so insurmountable that we as Christians are not willing to step into it. We are not willing to face it. It's simply not true. Our God is not lacking in ability. He wants us to have big dreams and see his kingdom come into this world. And so I close with this. I just want to invite you all, as we sit here in church, I want to invite you to be a part of that. That's the invitation that the church has. Slave owners and traffickers are relentless, and they're calculated, and they will be unafraid to use their power and money to oppress these people. They will not let them go. But we have the church. We are the church, and we must act. And so I want to ask you to partner with IGM. I would love for you to become Freedom Partners. You've received something in your envelopes today, in your bulletins. If you can just pull that out for a second. It says Send Rescue. So take a look at that. And it's just a way for you to become a supporter of IGM. What a Freedom Partner is to be able to give $24 or more a month. And it's an opportunity for you to pray and to be an advocate and to find a way to end slavery. That should be our mission as this generation. Let slavery end with our generation. Let it be something that you do, that we do. So I just want to have you take time right now. Just rip off that page, and you can just start filling that out. I'll give you a minute just to be able to do that. And then afterwards, in the back, you can drop it off, and you can join as a Freedom Partner. IGM teams are really ready to go. It's not just India, but in the Gulf of Thailand, in Ghana, in Latin America. We are able to see God bring his people into this work, but it's the resources that we need so that we can truly be able to do that. So let me pause. Let me give you a second just to start filling out this form, and then I'll just close us with a word of prayer. I think our God has a sense of humor, and so he delights in seeing the little guys win over the big guys. And he likes to do it in a way that at the end of the day, the Israelites had no way to pat themselves on the back when they defeated the Midianites and say, it was us. I'm a real good military general. It was my strategies. When you're 300 against 100,000, you know very well that it was only because God is on your side. And so that's not a bad place to be. For us to be in a place where we know we are empty, where we are weak, and where we need God at the foot of the cross, I think that's the place of greatest strength and greatest hope. So I just ask you to continue to pray for IGM. Thank you for the support that you are doing. So let me just close us in a word of prayer. Father, thank you again for just this body that you have stirred the hearts 10 years ago to walk side by side. And so we see the amazing things that God, you are doing in India, and where the heart of this church has been supporting. And we are just so grateful to see evidences of that. It's in your kindness, Lord, that you bring me to a place in a church, in an area where I had been when I first arrived in this country, and a church that I had first attended when I joined IJM. So the stories go, Lord, as you write it. But when we get a glimpse of your hand and your perfect plan, it does amaze us. We ask, Lord, that you would bring slavery to an end in our generation, that we would not be the in-between generation where slavery continued to exist through, but we would be the ones that stood up and said, no more, no more. Let your spirit be our strength, our guide, our support. Give us vision to see what it truly means for your kingdom to come. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.